Welcome to this Tuesday edition of Main Street here on Prairie Public. We are glad that you are with us. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Coming in the second half of today's show, from ancient forest migrations to prairie droughts and double-cropped Iowa fields, we'll explore how history, tradition, and innovation are helping us face a changing climate. Hoofbeats, harvests, and all. And Main Street begins today with the fact that June is Men's Mental Health Month, and the time to shine a spotlight on the health challenges that men often face in silence. Dr. Alexandra Kohlhase is with us. She's a clinical psychologist at Essentia Health. Welcome back to Main Street.
Thank you so much for having me.
Silence. Oftentimes men just don't want to reach out to get help.
That's right.
Let's start right there. This area just went through a traumatic event last Friday. Weather-related, obviously, with tornadoes and hail. Many people woke up, and I bet their mental health was the last thing that they were thinking about. What would you tell them?
Well, it's so interesting, isn't it? Because everyone's physical safety was top of mind, right? But oftentimes, we don't think about the mental health side of things. We can't really separate those two. I think I would start there by saying that if our physical health is threatened or compromised, it has a direct impact on our mental health, and vice versa. If our mental health is compromised, that affects us physically. I think we're doing a better job about being more open and more transparent about our emotional well-being, but it's every bit as important as physical health. And I think that, you know, in reference to what happened on Friday, there are lasting emotional impacts for people who were impacted by the storms.
Men,
by the tornadoes.
Women, and children.
Everyone, yes.
What would you tell that man who is now maybe taking a breath and realizing that this is something that will impact me the rest of my life?
Mm-hmm. First and foremost, that is not a sign of weakness. And I think that one of the parts of the stigma surrounding mental health is that it is weak to feel sad or to feel scared. It's weak to ask for help. And that's simply not true. I often find myself telling people that strength comes is demonstrated by doing what's difficult. So if it's hard to ask for help, but you do it anyway, that's actually courageous and that's actually strong. So I think we need to flip that narrative on its head and reframe what it means to be brave and strong, and to recognize that regardless of our age or our gender or our demographics, that everyone deserves help when they're having a difficult time.
I think that in the Fargo area, in the eastern side of the state, there are more people like you, Dr. Kohlhase, but maybe in Wishick, or in Enderlin, or in other places, there aren't as many mental health professionals than perhaps are needed. What then?
We're so fortunate. I would say the one positive outcome, perhaps, of the COVID-19 pandemic is that telehealth became such a prominent way to receive medical care. So I think I would encourage people to know that no matter where you are located, that is an option. I think that the issue is being able to get connected to those services. So, you know, one of the best ways to get connected to mental health services is by going to your primary care provider and having them help do a little research and find someone, even if it's hundreds of miles away, who can provide telehealth services. Aside from the accessibility of those services, I think the other thing that sometimes inhibits people, especially in these really small communities, is everybody knows everything about everyone.
Everyone knows everyone's business.
Absolutely. Yes. And so sometimes we, you know, hold our cards close to our vest, so to speak, because we don't want people to know that we're struggling, and that can make it really hard. You know, if your doctor is also your second cousin or your in-law, it's hard to say, I'm having a really tough time. I need to get set up with a therapist.
And you talk about people hiding things. I think that some people have a public face and then a very private life. So what are some common signs of poor mental health in men that often go maybe even unrecognized or certainly unspoken?
Mm-hmm. I'm so glad you're asking that question, because poor mental health, or, you know, compromised emotional well-being, does look different in men often than it does in women, than it does in children. I think that we sometimes attribute emotional outbursts or emotional difficulties to the old anger management issues, right? Like, this man is just angry, or, you know, this man just has, quote, a drinking problem. And I feel very confident that, you know, with all the people who I've treated over the years, there's always something underneath that. People aren't just angry. It's a trauma response, it's fear, it's shame, it's embarrassment, it's uncertainty. And so I think men maybe feel safer being angry. That's more of an acceptable response, especially if they're really feeling pressure to maintain that strong facade. But giving themselves permission to dig a little bit deeper. There's a reason for that, and there's a reason that people turn to substances. It's not just a drinking problem, right? It's masking or, an attempt to cope with something a lot deeper.
Men have a hard time being vulnerable, mm-hmm. it seems to me. Mm-hmm. Women perhaps are better at that?
I think that we have given women permission to do that. I think that it's more comfortable, perhaps, or it's more acceptable. I think that especially, we're kind of moving away from this, some of these old ideals, but men, the head of the household, the breadwinner, the protector, there's not a lot of room in that paradigm for vulnerability. Meanwhile, women, what is old saying? Women are the fairer sex, right? Like it's okay to be emotional and to cry. And quite frankly, that explanation, that viewpoint, it's very damaging. It's damaging to everybody.
Once it's recognized that a man may have some mental health concerns, what usually happens next?
I would say that once a man is willing to admit that and say, yep, you know what, I really could use some support. I think that one of the most helpful things is to be able to be transparent about that, to be able to share that with family and to be able to reach out, whether that's a primary care provider or, another specialist, and just say, look, I'm dealing with some tough stuff. I really would like to have a consult, right? It's not even a guarantee that you're going to engage in long-term therapy. Let me go talk to somebody, tell them what I'm dealing with, maybe come up with a diagnosis, and they can help me figure out my options.
In your work, what are the most effective ways, Dr. Colhase, you found to engage men in conversations, to start talking about their mental health or become mental health aware? And I'm asking maybe from the point of view of a family member who wants to engage their spouse, their dad, their uncle, but really doesn't know what to say.
Well, I think that, and I'm not sure if this is a gender-linked trait necessarily, a lot of people, when they're struggling, they don't necessarily want someone to try to fix it. Oftentimes, they just want to be heard. And so I think that sometimes, whether it's a partner or an adult child or, anyone in that person's life, to say, I really think you should do X, Y, and Z, that usually doesn't work very well. That usually tends to raise people's defenses. So certainly helping people to just start talking without judgment, without criticism, maybe without trying to fix it, just to be a sounding board. The easiest in to build trust with someone is just to listen and validate what they're going through, to reflect what I'm hearing and to say, well, you feel really alone or you feel really ashamed. It's even hard to walk in here through my door. Like, that's pretty amazing that you're able to do that. That's a great place to start, to kind of call it out and acknowledge that this isn't an easy step, but that's something to be proud of.
We're enjoying our conversation with Dr. Alexandra Colhase. She's a clinical psychologist at Essentia Health. Dr. Colhase, for many, therapy is a solution. For many, medication's a solution. What should men in particular be thinking about that process, that road, that journey to becoming stronger relative to their mental health?
Well, I think that really acknowledging and accepting that it's that they're best served by having a holistic approach, right? I think that recognizing that sometimes physical health symptoms are indicative of an emotional health concern, recognizing that not addressing their emotional health concerns will catch up with them and have physical effects. Also thinking about sort of the messages that we want to send our children. So if men would like their children to be able to ask for help, if men would like their children to be able to identify their feelings, it's really important for men to be able to do that and model that for their kids. It's one thing to say, yes, it's okay to ask for help, but kids see everything. If they hear that from dad, but they're not seeing dad do that, that's a mixed message, and they're a lot less likely to do that for themselves.
Where do hobbies and exercise and those things, I guess, come in to men's mental health?
Mm-hmm. I think that for everyone, it's really important to have an outlet, and it's important to have something, a coping skill, a healthy coping skill, a distraction. I think that a lot of men will turn to exercise, hobbies, whether it's golfing or woodworking or, you know, camping, anything that can help them regulate, maybe decompress a little bit, take their mind off of what's stressful. Those are all really important, again, like healthy tools in the toolbox. I think there's a fine line, right, between having a whole list of things that you can go to when you're really stressed out, but also coming back to it later, coming back to the stressor and, again, giving yourself permission to process through it. These things catch up with us. You know, if we try to just sort of repress them and say, well, I went for a long run and so I'm not going to think about it anymore, it will come back, right? So it's a matter of maybe using that as kind of a Band-Aid in the moment, but then returning to the stressor and dealing with it head on when you're able to.
I've often thought about the way my parents aged. My mom had every social connection in anybody's playbook. Something to do on Monday, a luncheon on Tuesday, coffee on Wednesday, church on Thursday. I mean, you go down the list and the community was there. My dad, on the other hand, worked at two jobs all of his life. When it came time to retire, he had none of that social infrastructure built in. And that was, I think, the most difficult part of aging for him. Is that common for men?
Absolutely. I mean, it sounds like, you know, the example you give with your dad, that was his identity. Right. And all of a sudden, if that's sort of where he's like poured all of his time and effort and energy and that's taken away, what do you do with that? You know, I think there's a huge loss of identity. And I think that especially for a man who is the breadwinner, head of the household, feels like they need to be the provider, it can be a real identity crisis, I think, to almost have to reinvent yourself later in life.
So then men really are at a higher risk of social isolation, I think I hear that you're saying. So what should men do relative to their mental health, and then how that extends to conditions like dementia or Alzheimer's, perhaps?
So I do think, you know, when you talk about, you know, a coffee date or like playing bridge or going to church, like those tend to be, I think, female dominated activities. And so if you have that structure in place, you have same age friends, right, who are maybe at a similar stage in life, and that's a real protective factor. It's maybe less common, right, for men to have those things. And I do think that that's a huge challenge, right? Like if you don't have a lot of other hobbies, if you don't have other ways to connect with people outside of work, yes, later in life you're losing your identity, you are no longer working, you don't have friends or buddies, there aren't things that you really want to do on the weekends. You kind of have to start from scratch, right? And like, how do I form relationships? And oftentimes, men are uncomfortable with that, maybe don't know how to do it. And yes, can that be a contributing factor to further issues and not being able to like keep cognitively sharp? Absolutely.
So we recognize that in our dads. I don't want to use the term intervention. That's harsh. However, I think we can help. What would be the best ways to engage someone? Touched on it earlier, but specifically with, boy, dad is socially isolated. Now I see it. What should happen? What should a family do?
Well, I think that's probably twofold. It's not just thinking ahead to the future, like when dad retires, this is going to be a problem. But any sign maybe that people's behaviors are changing. Dad used to really enjoy doing this. He's not doing it anymore. Why is that? I mean, that can be a sign of depression, social withdrawal, loss of interest in things that you used to enjoy. So I think that can be a red flag, you know, asking the question like, hey, dad, you used to do this every Monday. You haven't been in 3 months. Like, what's going on?
Can older men be successfully treated for depression just like someone who is maybe 30 years or 40 years younger can be treated successfully?
Absolutely. Yes. That's a short answer.
Yeah.
I mean,
is the way to get to that success different for older men?
I think that there are probably more barriers to break through with the stigma, with the generational idea of, you know, accepting that mental health is real. I think it's also harder to break old habits, right? If somebody's in my office and they're 20, right? They've only been engaging in these, you know, maladaptive or avoidant skills for 5-10 years. If somebody comes in and they're 70, they've been doing it a whole lot longer. So I think that it probably takes more repetition. It probably takes more conversations about, you know, it's okay to talk about how you're feeling. What you're going through is normal. There's nothing wrong with you. It can be a longer road, but it's just as worthy. Everybody deserves to be happy no matter where they're at in life.
Are there new techniques or promising developments or resources that you are now turning to treat mental health issues, especially in men today?
You know, one of the things that we have started, we have a ketamine clinic. So for people especially who have like more severe or like treatment resistant depression, ketamine is very helpful. So that's something that that we've been using and have seen quite a bit of success with that. I think there's always new research about, you know, the way that we should be eating and exercising and taking care of ourselves. And I don't think that there's a one single tried and true diet or exercise regimen, but you know, the old adage of, you know, move your body and fuel your body appropriately, that's always legitimate.
Speaking of new things that we've heard about.
Yes.
Just yesterday came across our desks in media that maybe 4 strawberries a day can keep me mentally sharper, maybe put off dementia even. But we hear things kind of like that all the time, that, hey, do this, but don't do that. Mm-hmm. But then don't do this and do that. How do we know what we should worry about, use that term worry kind of with emphasis, mm-hmm. to help our mental future?
Mm-hmm. It's so hard, right? Because we hear all these different things, sometimes competing words of wisdom, and then sometimes we hear something and a month later it's, you know, debunked. It's hard. I would say if it's something like that where it's like eat more fruits or eat this fruit that's good for you, why not? Do it and see what happens. I think that the risk that comes with that is if people do that to replace something that's maybe scarier or more threatening. If I eat strawberries and I get on my treadmill for 20 minutes a day, I don't need therapy. Like, I think that that is a kind of a dangerous slippery slope. And I think that if you have some of these tools at your disposal and you're really having a tough time, throw everything at the wall, right? And like see what sticks. I don't think that eating 4 strawberries a day is a good replacement for professional help. But I would certainly say there's no harm in adding that to the regimen.
Dr. Kohlhase, as you look at your practice and as you look about the data here in the region, are mental health challenges becoming more prevalent that you see and that you want to work with and want to help?
Yes. I say that with hesitation because I don't know how much of it is that they really are more prevalent or if we're just more aware and talking about them more. But I think, especially in my work with children, kids have so much to worry about these days that they did not have to worry about, you know, decades ago. And I think that untreated, worried, sad, lonely kids, if they're not helped, they turn into lonely, sad, worried adults. So yes, I think it's extremely prevalent. And I think these days everybody has something, right? Even if it's not at a clinical level. It's just, it's hard. It's the world's hard. There are lots of pressures and lots of fear and lots of hatred. And I think that that affects everybody.
I often think of social media and the problems that we've all heard about, it's in the context of teens, perhaps, or young adults, or even middle-aged folks. It's rarely with older folks, it seems to me. Are you seeing in your practice where even what we do on our phones impacts folks who are in their 60s, 70s, and 80s?
Mm-hmm.
Really?
100%. I think it's different. Probably not the same, like, bullying or ostracizing that, you know, we see among, like, teens today. But a lot of what older adults struggle with, I think, is this constant comparison, feelings of inadequacy. You know, my neighbors went on this vacation. My, you know, in-laws have such and such a car. Like, everybody's putting everything out there. Well, I take that back. Everybody's putting all the good stuff out there.
Right?
All the stuff that they feel proud of or that they kind of want to brag about. And that creates deep feelings of insecurity in people who are thinking, well, I'm not doing enough or I haven't been successful enough in my life because I don't drive a car like that. So I think that the pressures are different. I think that the other sort of consequence of that, right, is that people are just on screen so much more. So it's harder to connect with family members. It's harder to connect with adult children, grandkids, right? Because everybody is just glued to their screens, or, you know, want to have a text relationship or a video chat relationship instead of going and spending time with grandma and grandpa face to face.
Do you ever remind folks that algorithms are designed to attract and keep folks glued to their screen? And what is their reaction?
I think that a lot of people know that. I also, you know, will remind them people are just putting out there, you know, the face that they want other people to see.
No leaky roofs.
Right. Exactly.
In the photos.
Exactly. Like, you know, you're talking about how great your vacation was, but, you know, what's life like at home? People aren't advertising when they're having a really tough time in their marriage or when their kids are struggling. So it's encouraging people to keep things in perspective, but it's also validating, you know, okay, you're feeling really insecure because you saw this picture. Digging a little deeper, like, that's what I want to talk about. Why is it important to you to keep up with the Joneses, right?
So let's go back to the start of our conversation. If you're a man or a woman, I should say, we're focused on Men's Health Month here, and you did experience a tough, tough weekend, or for quite a while now, you've wondered if you need mental health services, the first thing that should be done is what?
Start talking about it. That sounds so simple, right? But like, it doesn't really matter. Just open up. Just say, I'm having a tough time. I'm sad. I have this, you know, going back to the idea of what happened with the storms. Like, I'm having these reoccurring intrusive thoughts. Talk about it. You know, I talked to some teenagers who are like, I'm the only person in my school who feels this way. I am the only person in my grade who's depressed. And so we talk about like, what, like, tell me about your perception. Is that because other people don't talk about it? Well, yeah, I'm the only person. I said, do you talk about it? Well, no. And so it's like everybody's in their own little bubble of pain and suffering, thinking that everybody else is okay. That's quite simply not true. You know, the minute somebody's brave enough to stand up and say, I'm really struggling, I'm depressed, I guarantee you're going to have other people who are like, oh, I know what that's like. Me too.
I feel like you do.
Mm-hmm. And that is really powerful, that in itself, just to feel like you're not alone.
As we wrap it up, I have a cut on my hand. I put a Band-Aid on it. A week later, that cut's gone. I see it. But with folks you treat, you can't see that sort of healing. It doesn't happen overnight.
It does not happen overnight. No.
Do some people have to be reminded of that, or some families, that this takes time and it could take, and I don't want to put words into your mouth, months, years?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I think there are some people who probably, based on the severity and depth of their trauma and, you know, the longevity of it, they might be in therapy forever. That's not a sign that you're broken. It's okay. And I tell people that all the time. I think sometimes it's this idea of like, there's something really wrong with me. Usually the conversation is more like, you've been deeply wounded. And just like, you know, if you had a broken limb and you needed to do PT on and off for the rest of your life to make sure that you're functioning to your optimal ability, nobody would bat an eye at that. You know, let's give the same grace to people who are seeking help for their mental health.
Grace is a great word. Dr. Alexandra Cole-Hase, she's a clinical psychologist at Essentia Health. June is Men's Health Month. Doesn't mean just physical health, although we're going to talk about that in an upcoming Main Street, but certainly their mental health as well. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
Still to come on Main Street, what do ancient horse migrations, prairie droughts, and cereal rye have in common? They're all offering fresh insights into how we weather today's climate challenges. From indigenous science to Iowa soil, that's ahead on Main Street right after this news.
This is Our Living Lands, and I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Understanding ancient horse migration patterns could help us adapt to climate change. That's according to a new study from a team of indigenous and non-indigenous researchers. Our Living Lands producer Daniel Spalding spoke to Lakota scientist Dr. Yvette Running Horse Collin about their work.
Can you help us understand the Shunwakan, the horse nation, and why it's considered a keystone species in indigenous knowledge systems?
Absolutely. So according to many of our Lakota knowledge keepers, our relationship with Shunwakan, the horse nation, is a deep ancestral one. So for more than two decades, I've had training in our Lakota sciences specifically involving the horse. So it's really important to understand that the majority of our time living alongside the horse nation occurred before Europeans came to the Americas. And so as Lakota, we didn't know the horse trapped in corrals or stalls like they're kept today. So in spending time with them like this, really going into their world rather than expecting them to interact with us in ours, we learned about the key roles they play in balancing the ecosystem. As a Lakota scientist, my primary role is to understand and protect life. I work collaboratively with my elder knowledge keepers to do this work. So as we've been taught, in order to find balance as Lakota, we follow the horse. So it's natural that we would follow the horse in our scientific research as well. So in order to tell the horse's story, we understand it's important to reflect as many horse cultures as possible. We have a team of more than 57 international researchers, including 18 indigenous scientists. We have them from the Lakota, the Okanagan, the Blackfoot, the Dene or Athabaskan, the Inupiaq Nation.
As we face growing environmental impacts, how can restoring the Shunwakan, the horse nation, to its rightful place in the ecosystem help support biodiversity and land health?
So many of the systems that have been put in place to manage land, they were put in place in a really different time period. It's really important to be able to reevaluate these policies. And if they're not working, it's important to be honest about that and implement a new path forward so that we can preserve life for today and for future generations. So what if I told you that changing the way we understand the horse and allowing it to live and move within its natural patterns could help reduce some of these unexpected fires that we see, you know, kind of raging today? Or what if I told you that, you know, allowing certain life forms to live the way they were created to live, you know, has the power to balance out some of this imbalance that we see today? So wouldn't that be something to consider?
How does incorporating a Lakota scientific principle help interpret the data in ways that Western science alone might miss?
In our Lakota science and many other indigenous sciences, we actually try to step back and understand the whole first, right? So in this study, we bring together ancient DNA work, genomic sequencing, indigenous knowledge, isotope analysis, right? We want to take you back to a time between 50,000 and 13,000 years ago. And so we wanted to go back to that time, a time of great environmental change, and take a look at what was happening there. And so in that, we follow the horse nation and they show us how they moved and also why they moved, right? As environment changes, it moves with that change. We understand when the horse moves, that all of that moves with it, and that necessarily affects the environment.
Can you share about what that relationship looks like in practice and why honoring it matters now more than ever?
So if we look at the world today and we look at the land management practices today, right? As a Lakota scientist, it's quite alarming. So if we don't like the mosquito, right? We spray the area with pesticides and we kill it, right? And in the process, we kill countless other life forms. We need to stop and we need to think about the effect that removing even one of these life forms has on the others around it. So this is something that our team really wants to focus on. We have a system that starts really far out from a big scope and then goes in that way. And so we are hopeful that this model is one that others will take a really close look at. And if they like it, find ways to incorporate it into their work going forward.
Tune in next week for more stories about how climate change affects tribal communities. I'm Antonia Gonzalez for Our Living Lands, a collaboration of Kuwanic Broadcast Corporation, Native Public Media, and the Mountain West News Bureau.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
Do bans on plastic bags work? That story and more on H2O Radio's weekly news report I'm Jamie Sudler.
I'm Franny Halperin, and it's This Week in Water.
The Colorado River is over-allocated, and since January, the seven states in the upper and lower basins have been meeting to work toward an agreement on how to divvy up water to avoid having the federal government decide it for them.
Last week, researchers from Stanford University proposed a market-based approach that would help sustain not only people and farmers, but also fish.
According to their study, 44 out of 49 fish species native to the Colorado River are threatened, endangered, or extinct. Unless there are considerable cutbacks in water usage in the basin, there could be serious consequences for them during at least a month of the irrigation season.
The Stanford team says that existing programs don't prioritize sustaining critical habitats, but fish could be saved at nominal additional cost by paying those with senior rights to conserve water and then send it strategically to designated areas.
The scientists say that the use it or lose it principle of Western water law can be a disincentive to conservation.
A UN global summit ended on June 13th, aimed at advancing conservation and the sustainable use of the ocean, with a goal of safeguarding 60% of the seas outside national boundaries.
The conference in Nice, France, the third and largest ever, with over 15,000 people attending, included the leaders of 60 nations, along with thousands of environmentalists, scientists, and business leaders.
Previous meetings resulted in a high seas treaty meant to protect thousands of species, and so far it's been ratified by 50 nations, 19 of which delivered their approvals at the conference. As soon as 60 confirm it, it will come into force.
Ocean health is declining due to rising global temperatures, overfishing, and acidification. At the conference, 95 nations signed a declaration to end plastic pollution, but petrostates, including Saudi Arabia, Russia, and Iran, were opposed.
Currently, only 8% of the world's oceans are in marine protected areas, or MPAs, that restrict human activity to safeguard marine habitats and animals. At the conference, Tanzania, Chile, and Colombia said they would create or expand their MPAs, and French Polynesia announced it would create the largest one in the world, encompassing 5 million square kilometers.
The conference also discussed deep sea mining, a practice that French President Emmanuel Macron called madness, and he pressed for a global moratorium. Scientists have warned that the activities would cause irreversible loss of ecosystems and habitats, not to mention the destruction of carbon storage.
Some of the most devastating hurricanes to strike the U.S. in recent years have been notable for their rapid intensification, a pattern that researchers are trying to better understand to protect the public.
Typically, hurricanes form and grow with the right mix of sea surface temperature, ocean heat content, and wind shear, but a team from the University of South Florida found that another factor can influence whether a storm will gain strength: rivers.
In a new study, researchers analyzed Hurricane Idalia, which jumped from a Category 1 to a Category 4 in less than 24 hours as it raced toward Florida's west coast in 2023.
Right before Idalia formed, intense rain fell along the Florida Panhandle and coastal Alabama, dumping a massive plume of fresh water into the Gulf of Mexico. When that fresh water encountered seawater, it formed a thick barrier that prevented deeper, cooler water from being brought to the surface by the hurricane's winds, something that typically weakens storms.
Instead, Idalia fed off the trapped warm water and grew, causing widespread damage as it made landfall in Florida's Big Bend region as a Category 3 storm.
Meteorologists were caught off guard by Idalia's rapid intensification, and while the researchers don't want to overstate the role the rivers play in supercharging storms, they say it's worth factoring local and regional river activity into forecasts to make them as accurate as possible.
And finally, plastic bags. They're used only briefly, yet linger as pollution, often collecting on beaches where they harm marine life.
Over 100 countries have instituted bans or fees on plastic bags, and several U.S. states and cities have regulations. But up until now, there hasn't been research to determine if those laws are making a difference.
Now, a new study led by researchers from the University of Delaware and Columbia University say, yes, bag policies are working. The team analyzed data from thousands of shoreline cleanups across the U.S. and found that areas with bans or fees had fewer bags on beaches and, in turn, less of the waste entering the ocean.
While that's good news, they say that laws or ordinances are reducing, but not eliminating, shoreline plastic bag debris, partly because the pollution is growing in general, and laws can mitigate only so much.
They also found that state-level policies were more successful than ones implemented by a city or county, and, interestingly, fees on bags were more useful than bans at reducing the litter.
Nevertheless, their findings that regulations can make a difference will be useful evidence for the upcoming UN negotiations in August, when countries will gather toward finalizing an international plastics treaty.
That's it for This Week in Water. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
Main Street continues on this Tuesday. I'm Craig Blumenschein, and in this week's Plains Folk, Dr. Tom Ezern is headed to St. Paul with a message rooted in both history and lived experience. He reflects on why climate change has always been a force shaping life on the Great Plains, and why it's essential that North Dakotans write their own history of how we've weathered it.
I'm on my way to St. Paul for the annual meeting of the Agricultural History Society. Yes, there really is such a thing, comprising an impressive community of scholars, where I'm supposed to present a paper entitled A Hidden Hand, The Significance of Climate Change in Great Plains History. The particular honor and pleasure of this presentation for me is that I am doing it in collaboration with two splendid scholars who happen to be students of mine, Blake Johnson, who just finished his PhD in Great Plains History, and Dakota Goodhouse, who is closing in on his. Guys like this illustrate why it's important we have a PhD program in history in North Dakota. First, because they show we can attract great scholarly talent. More so, however, because having advanced graduate scholarship going on here gives us a voice in our own history. Sure, people from elsewhere study North Dakota topics, and it's important to have them working here so that we get a full and honest history. Peer review, checks and balances, you know. But if you get all your history done for you from elsewhere, then you will always be an intellectual and historical colony of someone else. We have to import avocados because we can't raise them here. History, we should grow a good part of it for ourselves. Last year, Blake won the Morrill Prize for graduate research in history at NDSU. This year, he nominated Dakota for the prize, and he won it. I'm in excellent company. As for our subject, climate change on the Great Plains, it is fraught with contention, which says a lot about the state of the country. As both a farmer and a historian, I can tell you every farmer or historian with his head on straight knows climate change is real and profound. People get distracted by the blame game. Who's responsible for climate change or not? That's not our subject. We're talking about the history, and it's a long history, of people dealing with, perhaps even prospering by, directional climate change on the prairies. For about 400 years, people here and abroad lived under the conditions of what has been known since 1939 as the Little Ice Age, a climatic era that concluded in about 1850. The Little Ice Age is the reason people called this the Great American Desert. Before 1850, the climate was severely cold on average and also significantly drier than it is today. This meant long, cold winters, but largely open, not much snow cover. A relatively stable climatic regime. Stability, open winters, these are the conditions that enticed open-range cattlemen to believe they could winter cattle on the range without shelter or supplemental feed. They weren't crazy, but their climatic intelligence was outdated as the climate had begun to warm about 1850. Now, warmer, that's good, right? Well, no. Warmer also meant more humidity in the air, thus more snow that covered available forage, and a catastrophic increase in meteorological oscillation, violent extremes of weather. Think the disastrous winter of 1886-87, Charlie Russell waiting for a Chinook. Warmer and wetter, well, that tipped things toward field agriculture instead of herding. But the factor of catastrophic oscillation, that was the rub. As I said, I'm not only a historian, I'm also a partner in a family farm, in the middle of a 5-year drought rivaling that of the 1930s. We need history not just for scholarly interest. We need it to figure out how to live in this place.
That was our dear friend, Dr. Tom Ezern, a distinguished professor of history at North Dakota State University, and Tom shares his Plainsfolk essays with us each week here on Main Street. This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Farmers in Iowa are experimenting with intercropping, planting two crops in the same field at different times to improve soil health, reduce flood risks, and adapt to increasingly erratic weather patterns. While challenges like crop insurance and market access remain, early research suggests that this method could boost profits and prevent future disasters by keeping fields covered year-round.
On a farm in East Central Iowa, pale green seed heads brush the shins of two men as they walk through a field. Mike Bretz planted the cereal rye last October.
Got a little bit of growth going into the fall and the winter there. And of course, it starts coming up in the spring.
Bretz will harvest the rye in July, but it's not the only crop growing in his field. There are also dark green leaves in tidy rows spaced 30 inches apart. Bretz planted these soybeans mid-April and will harvest them in the fall. This type of overlap is called relay intercropping, and it's pretty rare to see on farms in the Midwest. But Brett says farmers need to change how they grow food to help deal with shorter, heavier bursts of rain and longer periods of drought.
It sure seems to me like it's different than it was when I was growing up as a kid, for sure, the weather patterns. But I think hopefully we can agree that whatever direction it goes, whether drier, wetter, or just more inconsistent, that it's going to be different.
He's one of dozens of farmers in Iowa collecting data as part of a research project focused on relay intercropping. Ross Evelsizer is leading the project. He's with Northeast Iowa Resource Conservation and Development, a nonprofit that works on solutions to water quality and flooding.
It's easier to stop the raindrop where it falls, and that means improving the soil health and keeping that ground covered.
Most conventional farm fields are bare after harvest until late spring. With relay intercropping, farmers keep living roots in the soil year-round. Cereal, rye, and other cold-loving crops prevent topsoil from washing downstream or blowing away. They also suppress weeds, support beneficial microbes and earthworms, and add organic matter to the soil, allowing it to absorb and release water like a sponge.
I mean, you can see the difference. You could probably have a pretty good rainfall and walk out here and not have muddy shoes.
Another benefit with relay intercropping is that farmers can sell two crops instead of one. Evelsizer's initial research results show farmers can have overall higher profit margins with relay intercropping, even with slightly lower soybean yields. But it relies on having at least one good rain during the second half of summer.
That's why it's not super common yet, more what I would call a little bit experimental.
That's Rob Myers, director of the University of Missouri Center for Regenerative Agriculture. He says another challenge with relay intercropping is crop insurance.
You can still get crop insurance in that system, but you have to be able to show that there is some data available that that practice, that relay intercropping, can be done in a way that won't hurt the soybean yield too much.
And of course, farmers need markets to sell their harvested cereal rye, either as cover crop seed, livestock feed, or for milling into flour. Despite the challenges, Myers says it could work for some farmers and help with flood control. Melissa Roberts directs the American Flood Coalition, which works on policies to help communities adapt to rising sea levels and more intense rainfall.
Half the land in this country is agriculture and farmland, and we cannot have solutions to flooding and disasters if we don't think about making that part of the solution and think about empowering farmers.
The American Flood Coalition supported a study that quantified what the downstream impacts would be if relay intercropping was scaled up across a watershed. Researchers found 500 buildings and homes could have been saved from a devastating 2016 flood in Cedar Rapids, Iowa's second largest city. With more data, the researchers are hopeful they can identify best practices with relay intercropping to help farmers and communities adapt to weather whiplash. I'm Rachel Kramer, Harvest Public Media.
This story was produced in partnership with Harvest Public Media, a collaboration of public media newsrooms in the Midwest. It reports on food systems, agriculture, and rural issues.
This is Dakota Datebook for June 24th. The conditions for North Dakota farmers in the early 1930s could be summed up in one word: dismal. Farmers were receiving less for their crops than it cost to produce them. They were on a wild economic roller coaster from the early 20th century until World War II. Wholesale prices increased dramatically with World War I and peaked shortly after it ended. But as European farmers resumed production after the war, prices plummeted. Wheat that sold for $2.45 a bushel in 1920 sold for just 38 cents in 1933. Farmers were unable to pay their taxes or their mortgages. They couldn't buy new equipment or pay off the debt on what they already had. It was a recipe for disaster. President Franklin Roosevelt recognized that American agriculture was in trouble. He included farmers in his first efforts to relieve the financial pain of the Great Depression. The Agricultural Adjustment Act was part of the first programs in Roosevelt's New Deal. Using the government's authority to tax and spend, the act regulated agricultural production. The AAA provided financial incentives to limit crop production, reducing surpluses and raising prices. Roosevelt didn't stop there. He sent a delegation to a World Economic Conference in London. On this date in 1933, North Dakotans learned that Australia was leaning towards supporting American efforts to reduce the worldwide surplus of agricultural products. Canada, Argentina, and Russia had already agreed to the American plan. The Bismarck Tribune noted that if Australia did sign on, it would be a cause for celebration. Several smaller countries had not yet agreed, but the newspaper believed they would follow the lead of the five largest wheat producers. The AAA was not entirely successful. Farmers reduced acreage in 1933, but still produced more than they had the previous year. Farm prices rose 52% by 1935, but still lagged behind the rest of the economy. In 1936, the Supreme Court ruled the act unconstitutional because of a processing tax they deemed invalid. Congress later passed a revised version that eliminated the tax. The AAA was just one of many ways the federal government worked to provide relief during the Depression. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Dr. Carol Butcher. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
Who is the supreme leader who guides Iran?
He actually has much more control than an American president in the sense that he also has control over the media, he has control over the judiciary, the legislature.
And what did Ayatollah Ali Khamenei reveal with his response to a U.S. attack? The latest on the Mideast War on Morning Edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
And that's it for today's Main Street. We are deeply grateful that you spent time with us. Today, we focused on men's mental health, breaking the silence and tackling the stigma. Tomorrow, we'll shift to the physical side with expert advice on screenings, preventions and staying strong during June, Men's Health Month. That's ahead tomorrow right here on Main Street, and we look forward to seeing you again.